This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Hey, gang.
Welcome to Indie Comic Book Noise, episode 341. It's the comic book podcast that's sponsored by nobody, but facilitated by our good friends at the Comic Book Noise family of podcasts and the Deliberate Noise Network. I'm Steve Raker.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Andrew.
And we're here to talk about indie comics.
Anything, all right.
Anything that's not cowls and capes from the big two.
That Unity is pretty sweet.
Woo! You can find us on Facebook, on an Indie Comic Book Noise Facebook page, and there you can get our Twitter handles if you want to chat and give us any feedback, and you can listen to us on our other show, Marvel Noise, where we talk about all things Marvel. Andrew, we have you back, finally, from the cons.
Yes, it's been a crazy whirlwind schedule. I believe I had talked about my Emerald City adventures. I had 1 week off, and then it was WonderCon. Over Easter weekend, then it was C2E2, then it was Free Comic Book Day. So I got to tell comic book fans, that is way too much for the non-professional to do it, but some of it was locked in. WonderCon is a hometown show. It's just down the street, relatively speaking, in Anaheim. So I'm always going to go to that. It used to be up in San Francisco, but now it's down here. Presumably it'll be down here next year, but they haven't confirmed. Although it looks like the rumor is that it's going to be held over Easter weekend again, as it has been since they've moved down here. And I really wanted to go to C2E2 because not only is Chicago a fun town, but there are lots of people that we know that I would get a chance to meet, including Jerry McDade, who Steve has had the pleasure of talking to on the computer, both for Marvel Noise and for the Great Expectations podcast.
Pretty good, at least.
It was a little bit disappointing because Derek Coward was supposed to be there but couldn't make it. He was going to be coming down with Chris from the Collected Comics Library podcast. So I wanted to meet him, but that will be put off for another day, I guess. And I got to say, all these conventions have been a lot of fun. It's just having them in such quick succession is quite a lot. Chicago had the benefit of having the widest aisles I've ever been to, and I really loved it. I wish every convention. I got into it on Twitter with a person that put on conventions about that and how it can be a bit of a detriment, because if the aisles are really wide, the customers can stream down the middle and kind of avoid getting the hard sell from vendors. But my take is it really accommodates the customers, and is the hard sell really working nowadays? I don't know how you boys feel, but I never felt that, you know, I'm not going to get pushed into something.
Well, yeah, no, the same thing. We're big, we're adults, and we, know how to respond to getting, you know, huckstered if we're not interested, and how to, we're there with a certain amount of time and, perhaps a hit list or things we want to do. So sometimes you can allow yourself to get drawn in by stimuli, and other times you got something to do, so you try to be polite enough but move on, and sometimes they make it difficult for you have to kind of snub your nose at them, kind of a thing, unintentionally, but that's how they set up the interaction, so be it. I don't prefer it.
If they strong arm you by saying, hey, you only picked up $10 issues, if you spend an extra $10, you can pick $100 issues, then they might strong-arm me into buying more of their stock, because you can say no to more dollar issues. But it's not the traditional strong-arm.
What I liked about the Boston Comic Con last year, and I hope they do the same thing this year in early August, is they had a really wide center aisle that went all the way through where they had more of the regular booths and vendors, and went all the way straight up through the artist's alley. And what it did was it accommodated a central row of structural, like vertical beams, like columns that existed, and gave plenty of movement side and table space side on either side of them for the facing you know, artists at their tables, but it also gave a great gathering spot for the cosplayers to wander up and down that big main aisle, almost like their little parade in the middle, and you could still get around everybody. And it gave everybody elbow room and some breathing space that I think really benefited the customer. So we'll see how it works out again. I like the wider aisle, at least having one.
Yeah, I was just so impressed with the you know, I've been to a fair number of cons and never seen anyone that had committed to that, and it made me just happy, especially on the Friday when you were just completely free. Saturday it got a little busier, but still it was never, I mean, WonderCon is basically feels like little San Diego. It's put on by the same people, and I do love the show, but the crowd levels are crazy. And the other thing I liked about Chicago was they kept the artist alley together, and they had one section where they projected an artist's work, and there would be shifts. So like Nicola Scott would come for an hour, and whatever she's working on, it would be projected on those Elmos or overhead projectors or whatever they call them nowadays. So you could watch them, you know, shade or ink or whatever they're doing. And then every hour it would be a different artist coming and sitting down there. And I thought that was fun because you could just sit and you could see it from a pretty good ways off. So you could just kind of watch them do their artwork where you're not standing over them. It was almost like having a panel without having to go to a panel room.
It kind of reminds me of Fan Expo, but they don't have a projected. You're just sort of looking over their shoulder at what they're doing because they're working on a computer screen that's really big.
Okay. Yeah. I just because I like to watch them, but sometimes you can feel a little, you know, you don't want to stand at someone's booth, partly because they're trying to make money and also because it's just kind of weird to be peering over there. You know, you look for a little bit, but you don't want to feel like I'm staring, but there, the whole point of it was. The shopping, I broke down and bought some figures. They had some $5 figures on these J-hooks on this wall, and I bought a bunch of crazy figures for the first time. It was just a fun show. And WonderCon is always a blast because being a local show, I see a lot of people that I'm used to seeing buy a lot of books and picked up all kinds of wonder. The weird thing about Chicago, they did a bag check for security. I mean, it was the most half-assed bag check and it was completely useless. Like, they wouldn't even really look. You just open your bag and they didn't always make you do it and they just kind of peer in. And it was like I'd never been in a and it just seemed so pointless because either do a bag check or don't. Yeah. But all you're doing is wasting everyone's time. I mean,
hey buddy, is that a reprint Incredible Hulk 181 or is that a
well, yeah, the thing, what is, are they checking for?
Because it's so cold.
Andrew's stash.
I presume guns, because there's a lot of the handgun symbol with a line.
Violence at comic conventions.
It's Chicago, guys.
well, it is Gotham City.
So it was just weird. If you're going to do it, and I don't think you need to, but if you're going to do it, my suggested way is the random screening where they just pick one out of 100 and actually look in their bag. Because all we're doing is, you know, everyone's got jackets and scarves and books and everything, and you need to actually look in the bag. You can't just peer in because you can't see the bottom of it. So if you're going to do that, actually do it. But I also don't mind if they skip the whole process.
I think they looked at you and were like, just gave you the cursory pat on the back and passed you through.
So we all had a little bit of joking about that. And I did see a really fun Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor panel with Jill Thompson and Cully Hamner.
Now, they all got the full search.
And they're pretty funny if you get... I mean...
They are.
Yeah, I've seen Jill Thompson. She's good.
Someone brought, like, their 8-year-old kid. And you're like, oh, like, right in the front row.
Don't ruin it for everybody else by bringing your kid. They might tone it down.
So, yeah. So, basically, it didn't. The one phrase, a bouquet of dildos, was bandied about quite often. And it was just a fun... Totally inappropriate, but Jill had a great story about some cosplayer that was in a G-string, and it was done up as Mystique and, like, bent, dropped something right in front of her table and bent over, and she got the full show of
it. The full Monty.
And she had backed up so much she actually smeared the blue body paint on the corner of her table.
At least it was a blue smear.
So, yeah, but there wasn't a ton of, like, at WonderCon, there was much more sort of comics panels at C2E2. It's a lot of pop culture, you know, fan panels and stuff, which are fun, but they're generally not my thing. I also noticed more cosplay in Southern California. There was a lot in Chicago, not as much. And I tweeted a few. I tweeted a boomerang for Kevin.
That was sweet.
And he even had the little Thunderbolts buckle on. I thought you'd get a kick out of that guy. But yeah, I got to say, they were all super fun shows. The great thing, like I said, about Chicago was meeting all these. As you guys know, I talk a lot about King Bone Press as a comic company, and they have a pretty active presence in Chicago and also on the forums that we inhabit. So I got to meet a bunch of forumites other than Jerry McDade, which was
Monsta?
A blast.
John Carter?
Matt Monsta?
He's a good guy, isn't he?
Very good guy. John Westhoff.
He's local to Boston, so I get to see him at the Boston Con, too.
Brian Bowles. He's a local guy, but I ran into J.K. Woodard, who's always, he's an artist.
Yeah.
He does J.K.'s Happy Hour. He's always a lot of fun.
He does some good, really good Star Trek
stuff. Yes. And
Doctor
Wendy
Who stuff. And
yeah.
Wendy Freeman of Double Page Spread. So there was a big group of us that went out to dinner Sunday night with Wendy and J.K. and J.K.'s wife and a bunch of other people. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, it's just all in all. I'm not mentioning a quarter of the people I met. It'd be too long, and I didn't keep notes about everybody. But it was just so much fun to put names to faces.
Yeah,
that's been a great experience. The only thing missing, of course, like I said, would be shame Super Steve couldn't make it, because I highly recommend to all listeners to cruise a con floor with Mr. Raker if you get the chance.
This year, I'm afraid it's just going to be Boston for me. I gotta neurologically improve to the point where I'm working again, so I can feel a little more frivolous about spending my money selfishly to go on vacation without the family. You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah, we gotta convince you to cross the border at some point.
Yeah, that's the best bet for running into you guys. And McDade is probably going up to like Toronto and trying to all rendezvous there. But Andrew's a trickier prospect.
Yeah, I'm always difficult. But the social element of conventions has really increased my enjoyment of the hobby and my activity. I doubt I would read a quarter of the literally, I bet you I'd be reading, I can't, you know, what, 20% of the books I read now if it wasn't for the different people I talk to and introduce me to things. Also, I just wouldn't be as engaged in the hobby. Free Comic Book Day made another fun outing. Went and had lunch with a bunch of guys that I only see at cons and stuff like that. It just really, it's weird. Years ago, comics were much more of a solitary hobby for me. I didn't really have any.
Yeah,
I had a few friends that read, but it was kind of like the lonely man. You know, you just go and buy your stuff and read it, and that was it.
Where were you guys when I needed you?
It was in school.
Well, my problem was
the 90s.
I was late going and getting into cons. I've only been for the last 3 years now, or whatever, or 4 years. So I'm late in the game.
Apparently.
But it's really, I know a lot of people are concerned about crowds and such, but I would say try and find a local show. Look, they're all blowing up, so they're all going to be busy. But if you can locate one or two acquaintances or friends, and you don't need to hang out all day, but just, you know, maybe you get a snack together, meet up.
You don't even need friends. It's fun to share that there, usually.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you guys feel, but like I said, I like the social element of it a lot.
Just go get a snack.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, with Free Comic Book Day, we had a little crew that went out to this heavy metal themed burger restaurant.
Okay. Well done, please. All right, so then let's talk about some indie comics then.
Let's get to some comics here.
Since that's what you like doing so much with your pals. Let's do that thing.
Pals, though?
We are.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
I call pal. No backsies.
All right, so what? Reading? Yeah. Where do you guys want to start?
How about The Mercenary Sea? It's on my mind because Kevin mentioned it. It was one of the free number ones that was released on Free Comic Book Day through Comixology, so I picked up a digital free number one copy of it. And I think the digital format really lends itself to this work, because having it be backlit really brings out the almost like animation cell overlay look of the art. And the artist is Matthew Reynolds. The writer is Kel Simmons with a Y. You can figure out what
I love
y
this
is.
Cover.
This cover is so cool. Not only does it show the weight of a well-produced, natural-looking wave of water, and you get a look under the water, you get a look above the water, and you get a good taste of what the art gives you inside, where he does a lot of shading tones of the same color to delineate like darkness and depth and like a lot of use of silhouettes too. And you get some of that underwater as well as all over the inside of the book.
Yeah. If you look at this cover and you go, all of these elements don't interest me, then you probably won't enjoy this issue. Cause the cover has like the spy, the guy with the water gear, a gun, and then you have like the shark in the water and the submarine and like a guy with binoculars on top of a rock. I'm like, what more do you need?
The soldier on top of the rock with the binoculars too, who looks like he's in the classic plastic soldier figure yeah. from our youth. The guy with the field glasses also is really well rendered here and is also indicative of the rendering inside the book, which is more, again, of a coloring rendering. The use of black, like, lines, like outlines, like thin black lines, is sparsely and carefully used, contrasting using just another darker color palette of the same, you know, another tone, shade of the same color, basically, to show, like, the darker shades, and it's really works really well here on this guy's uniform, because then they can show his equipment belt in silhouette. And that's what's going on all over this issue. You get these pages that are like all blue or all brown. They have a and you're getting all these different tones and silhouettes all against each other. And sometimes it really works well. Most of the time when you're looking at scenery or action, it works well. But when it doesn't work well sometimes is the faces, because sometimes you get a sharp, dark line, like, delineating, like, the chin or jawline, but then all the shading, like, around the nose and cheeks is all just done in another color of flesh, and that can kind of look a little, I dare to say it, I won't even say it, because it's crueler than I mean it to be, but it just looks a little awkward, and a little animation cell-y in the wrong way at those times. But when it does work, I think it's really cool. And looking at it black backlit, I really liked how this book looked.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I saw the preview pages, and I'm like, is this going to look good for a whole comic? But there's only really one scene that really bugged me, is the whole popcorn eating thing. I was just like,
it bothered you visually?
Yeah. But otherwise, like, I'm like, there's a lot of silhouettes, but then it looks like there's like a background behind a background behind a background. It's like, how deep does that go? You'd think that would be a shortcut, but then like there's a lot going on. So I don't know. It seems to work. Like whenever people are talking or it's zoomed in, like that's when like it's all drawn. But when they're just showing you something that's going on, you don't necessarily need to see, or there's some dinosaurs or some crazy thing. It's like, oh yeah, we'll just use the silhouette mode, which is fine.
And the silhouette mode with the colors, doesn't it really look like a cinematic cutscene to like older video games when they were just starting to get into the better graphics, but they couldn't really show it, so you at least got the sharp black outline of things? And it was kind of when video games were making that next step, and some of those cutscenes would be done that way. And the use of making things be a little out of focus to show some of the depth too, which I oftentimes don't like in comics when they overuse it to show motion and stuff. Here it's more used, like I said, to show the depth and I think,
yeah,
or fog, you know, and I think it works really, really good.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed by that, by those effects, because usually I'm like, yeah, this might, it could end up looking too computerish or something, but it actually works out pretty well.
It's its own world, you know? When you step into it, you feel like you're kind of in there, and once you get used to the rules of the world, if you will, it's like, all right, and then you're chugging along on the story. Which the basic story is, it is, it's kind of like a period serial, like a pre-World War II, as serial story type beats with cliffhangers that you think are going to go one way and maybe they don't quite happen. What it is a team of rogue individuals on a submarine that they've gotten, and the submarine is old, and it's actually very Serenity, Joss Whedon Serenity-like. There's a cute chick who's a whiz with the engines, and they're using an old out of commission vessel that's got to, you know, be upkept with all that sort of business, you know.
Yeah, I guess I thought it was. I think you read three issues though, and I only read the one. But from the one, seems very action adventure-y type of thing, like maybe not quite a pulp, but something about it. It's like that pre World War II era. It's like when Marvel went to. Like almost Captain America is fighting the Nazis or something like that type of thing. And then you have that whole scene with like the Lost Island in the first issue and everything. It's like, yeah, like even those are cool things in themselves.
Thank goodness for that scene too, because that's what really drew me in. It's a new cast of characters. They're not superhuman or anything like that. So, you know, they're guys with dialogue that suits their personalities. And that's often a hard sell for me. So I kind of was drifting through the beginning part. And there's a nice story beat here where they all arrive on this island. And they're all in the jungle, as the inhabitants probably call it. And they come across a bunch of headhunters. And they're cannibals. And it's like, all right, everyone cool, you know. And it's like an Indiana Jones kind of a moment, you know. And then the next scene, it's like, they're buds, and what these guys have done is brought a movie projector and some old movies, or I guess there would be new movies to them, right? And they're showing Duck Soup to the cannibals, and everyone's like, and that's the popcorn eating that you're talking about, Kevin. That's why they're eating popcorn. Yeah. But that was cool, and they got this good bond friendship. These guys are rogues in this sub, so they hang out on the fringes, and instead of being eaten by the cannibals, they're the type of guys who are arm in arm with the cannibals, you know? And I have a feeling that's going to come back to help them out sometime in the future, having those kind of relationships with the scourges on the outskirts of the more civilized world, which is all getting ready for World War II right now. And that piece comes into it because we get an offer to become part of a spy plot. And I think that's how things are going to take kind of an espionage turn. But the captain of this vessel also has a personal search for this mythical, island of treasure and everything. So we've got that going on, too.
When the guy shows up with an eye patch and says, I got files on all of you, and then you find out, like, what kind of crazy background they have, and then it's like, we're going to go on this mission, and I'm like, sold.
Yeah.
I know it's one of those tropes, but I'm just like, yeah, that seems pretty cool.
I picked up the second issue, too. It's, this is a unique presentation as far as, you know, visually, and it's really pleasing to me. So it was a easy sell, and I'm definitely going to be checking out to see where this whole first storyline goes, because I think the writing is really fine and the artwork again is unique compared to the other books I'm reading right now.
I love cannibals, so I might check it out.
You'll like the head cannibal guy. He's cool.
Yeah, sounds cool. And I love, like you say, when they go to like a mystery island or something like that. I love that stuff too.
I was looking at it today, but Comixology was giving me grief. It wouldn't let me. Kept getting stuff. The error message when I went to read my books.
Oh, that's not good.
I think you got to sync it with the new Comixology.
Oh, update? Maybe.
There's some kind of sync procedure that you have to do to resync your account after the new thing.
To get I didn't have to do any syncing. I know in the instructions it says to do this. I'm like, no, you just download the
ones you want.
The new app. And then you just log in, and then, like, if you want anything, you just download it from the cloud.
I just noticed that they added the feature that was missing that everyone was complaining about, which is the read next issue, or if you want to go to the next issue. Now they have that when you get to the end of the issue. Even if you don't have the next issue, it now cues you and links you to the next issue to buy or read if you already have.
Yeah, that's a good option.
It sends you to the web?
Yes. It does. All right, what else is out there, guys?
I read something called V-Wars.
What is that? But
by IDW. It's, I'm sure like most people, vampires these days are just fucking stupid. Like, because the shows and the movies. But I find comics always do a really good job of putting a new take out there. Like, most vampire comics, for some reason, I end up enjoying. As long as they're not based on something that exists already. So,
Comic for you.
No, I like Angel, actually. So okay. That's the exception. But that's just because of the love for the DVDs or whatever. But so this one's IDW, like I said. It's written by Jonathan Mayberry.
Sure.
I can't remember what he's done before, but I know I recognize that name.
He did some work for Marvel with Daredevil, I believe.
Okay, that's probably it then. And then art by Alan Robinson. And colors J Photos. And just to bug Andrew, I'm not going to say the letter. And so, yeah, basically, the first page is awesome. It's this father holding this little girl with vampire teeth and blood all over. The rest of the family is just slaughtered because in this world, it's like a virus. Everyone has it in them, just like the Walking Dead universe almost. And so anyone can turn to a vampire at any time and just go nuts. And so basically in this world, there's vampires, there's normal people, and someone starts a war between both of them, which is why it's called V-Wars. And the really cool thing about it is there's this one character who's really innocent, which was the father of the little girl that slaughtered the family. And he's almost like the only innocent type of one in this world. Someone tries to give him information about how this all started, and it ends up being destroyed. The proof, so he's kind of in this position now where he's really screwed because he's the only one that knows how it really started, and he has to figure out a way to get proof again, I guess, as the series goes on. But yeah, it's one that I'm going to be picking up the rest for.
Cool. Is it a miniseries or an ongoing? Or
no clue. Not sure. I didn't read the text in the back, though, so I imagine it says it in there. Oh, there was a zero issue, which was like a prose. So they're in the back of each issue, they give you a part of the prose. So as it goes on, you'll get the whole thing.
Huh.
So that's kind of cool too. I didn't read it, and I doubt I will. But if you're into that kind of thing, it's a cool little option, extra thing.
I read a recent story arc from Dynamite Entertainment of the Warlord of Mars series. I dig John Carter stuff and am pretty up and down with the stuff that Dynamite has done, John Carter related. The opening, probably about 12 issues or so, I thought did a pretty decent job of doing some adaptations of the original, Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff. And then things kind of wandered a little bit. The art is kind of inconsistent to, you know, marginal at times as far as what I really want to get into when I'm looking at comic books. And some of the Dejathoris offshoot miniseries and regular series, some of them are hit and miss. A couple of them I've been really drawn into as far as what the plot is, and then other ones just seem to bore me to tears. But I have been at least trying to keep my nose a little bit to get a good sense of kind of what's been going on in the series. And issues number 31 through 35 of the main Warlord of Mars series is called The Tyrant of Mars, and it was five parts, written by Avrid Nelson, who does most of the writing for the series, with art by Wagner Reese. And one of the issues had a fill-in by a guy named Raphael Linhelis. Here, the story is, and I'm not sure if this is originally a adapted story from somewhere else or not. I couldn't find record of it, at least by that title, Tyrant of Mars. But it is a pretty connected to some pretty big elements of Carter mythos, so I'm assuming that there must be some connection to some other written work somewhere. But if not, kudos to Averd Nelson for coming up with some cool John Carter-like mythology here that's worthy of the ERB mythos. Here we've got Dejah Thoris's long-lost grandfather, who was thought, you know, slain, returns, seemingly from the dead, and John Carter relinquishes his warlord status to the grandfather because he's the rightful throne wielder. He wielded it once. And things start going really bad. He starts becoming a real, you know, dictator, basically, a despot. And the Thurns, the Tharks, Carter and Deja's full-grown son are all involved and all play their parts. Things get a lot worse before they get better. But along the way, you get the secret of the two tall pinnacle towers that are in Greater and Lesser Helium in the two cities. And that's what makes me think that some of this must be tied to, because those towers must have had some history that I'm just forgetting or never read in. I've only read maybe two and a half of the original Carter stories. But they get into what the origins of those two towers are and how they're kind of connected to what's going on with the grandfather. And it all gets resolved in the end, of course. And Carter, you know, kicks some butt. And the art is tells the story quite nicely. And the drama builds pretty good. So again, even if it is an adaptation, kudos, but lesser kudos to Averd Nelson for doing a good job keeping it more interesting and fast-paced than a lot of the other Carter stuff that I've come along, even the stuff written by Nelson.
When you mention Warlord, I inadvertently flash back to Mike Grell's Warlord.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, wait, that's a DC. Oh, no, he means John Carter Warlord. Okay, so now I'm back on the target. Although yeah, I will update everyone, I have started binds 3 and 4 of the original Sable, John Sable series by Mike Grell. So I'm going to have that thing done. It'll be 5 volumes, and I have all the comics. So once I get bound, I'll have a complete set in hardcover.
Wild.
It's awesome.
I mean, not as fancy as your store-bought hardcover, but...
No, yeah. If you had to stitch an open wound in the field, you could probably manage the dress.
Now it's easy to read.
I can find someone to maybe do a little artwork or something for one of these covers, too.
Maybe you run into Grell at the convention.
What about the Dream Police, guys? You were saying that you guys read that. And I'm interested.
It caught my eye. I enjoy JMS. I'm not the biggest fan, but I'm also not the biggest detractor. He seems to be a guy that runs controversial for people. Like, I think he's never done my favorite comics, but he's done a lot of comics that I've really enjoyed, and I don't ever remember being one. Even the Spider-Man stuff, I never wasn't one of those that's like, oh, he's ruined comics for me or whatever.
I think isn't the reason a lot of the people are detractors is because they actually liked some of his concepts and stories and that he didn't finish them, though? So, even the haters are likers, you know?
Right. But you know how that...
They're just spurned.
At some point he seems to, like, run off the rails.
But even some of the ones they complain about, it's not that they're that bad, really.
Well,
it just gets a little slow, I think.
Well, like, I think you thought they were fine, but other people said, yeah, that's not a good ending.
Yeah. Like, what's that one, not Supreme Powers, but has a name like that?
No, Rising Stars.
Rising Star.
Yeah, I think you thought that was fine, but I know a lot of people are like, no, that was not fine by the end.
Yeah, I thought it was good. It was just very slow, like, after the... Because the fighting ended, like, halfway through or something like that, like, all the action stuff, and then it got all kind of political and heal the earth type thing, but it was okay.
I mean, what I like is that he's willing to... I think he tells catchy stories, and he's willing to go out there. And those are and so even if it's not a super home run, I enjoy that he's trying something, and he's going to do something his own way. Probably my top work of his would be Midnight Nation, I think, was the thing I liked the most. that he did. And it's not without its flaws, but I really like that he was trying for something when so many superhero comics kind of just do superhero comics. Like, he was trying to incorporate other messages in it. And, you know, maybe they didn't all work, but I like that ambition. And it was fun for me to be like, oh, I wish more people would push and try and have bigger ideas in it to see what happens. I think it spurned some interesting discussions. But Dream Police, what really caught my eye was I saw Bill Farmer. And I was thinking, holy cow, Bill Farmer, the voice of Goofy in Disney Legend, also works in comics?
Oilk?
And that would be no. Bill Farmer, Disney Legend and voice of Goofy, is separate from Bill Farmer, colorist for comic books. But still, you had to admit, that would be a pretty cool crossover. And the artist here is Sid Koshin. I am not familiar with Sid's work. I'm going to assume it's a guy. I don't know. But I found it to be, it worked for me. Like, the art was successful. So the premise is there is a dream state where people go. And that dream state has people that maintain it. There are architects, there are people that facilitate your dreams, and there are dream police. And we follow two such detectives, Joe Thursday and his partner Frank Stafford. And they have very clipped Dragnet-style dialogue that at first I found a little off.
Yeah, well, you knew what they were going to say before they said it. Like,
yes. But I think because of the twist at the end, it works. Like, and when that twist happened, I'm like, oh, that works. So they have kind of a timelessness about them. Like, they don't know how long they've been. From their perspective, they've always been there, and they've always been partners, and they're sort of stuck in this situation that seems endless. And they help make the dreams go efficiently. And there are so there are people that work there, and that, like I said, architects that, like, build the dreamscapes, and then other characters that inhabit your dreams and make the dreams come out the way they're supposed to. And there's also a nightmare group, which are these creepy top-hatted gentlemen. And obviously no one wants to run into the nightmare people. So they're able to see past the facade, and so the people that facilitate the dreams look kind of like they're made out of wire mesh, and the mechanisms are wire mesh. But as a dreamer, you would see it as your Aunt Sally or whoever was supposed to be. And what happens is they run into trouble when a lucid dreamer shows up. I thought that was so funny that, like, that's right. Like, a lucid dreamer can control their reality, and that's a problem for them. That's what I mean about clever ideas. I just thought it really worked. And then at the end, so they have to call in the Nightmare Squad. And the Nightmares...
Well, it's not that they have to. It's just every once in a while, the Nightmare Squad will approach them and ask them if they need help. And then this time they were like, yeah, we do need your help.
And so you don't want to...
Which is not a good thing.
No. Well, not for the person that wants to be in the... So the Nightmare Police take care of that situation, and it seems kind of ominous. But when we after that, as is their routine, they end up going back to a diner. And they're like, oh man, your jacket, he got shot, so you're going to have to get a new jacket. And they've always gone to this diner. And Joe's partner is like, mentioning he's got this strange feeling that something's totally wrong. And that it's weird. And Joe's like, okay. And then he's like, all right, are you ready to go? Are you feeling better? And he goes, yeah. And Joe's like, okay, we got to get back to requisition and get a new outfit. And then you turn the page, and Joe's partner now is someone called Katie. And she's like, how long have we been partners, Joe? And Joe's like, we've been partners forever. And it just was this nice moment where, like, obviously his partner saw something wrong, and he was instantly replaced, and there was no notice of it. And I thought that was, like, just a great hook. And it fit with that clipped kind of dialogue perfectly. And so I thought that was, like, a really clever, like, it's an interesting premise. Phil, what are your comments?
I loved it. I think I love just, like, some of the comedy in it, even when they were on their first case, and just him having to deal with the person who helps move along the dream.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the person that moved along the dream threw a kink in it, and so they had to they had to straighten him out, or her, or it, or whatever it is.
And you don't realize that's what's happening until later on, so... So I don't know, I thought that worked well with me, and I love the nightmare guys, and just the scene where whenever they take off their hats, it's a face piece too, and then everyone looks away because no one stares at them, but there's one character that does, and the guy asks him, why do you do that, and he says, because they'll get mad, and he's like, I think they respect me because of it. I thought that was a pretty cool scene too.
Yeah, but that twist at the end
was really...
It was well handled, too. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it coming. I should have noticed from the cover, but it didn't really... I have the alternate cover by Renee DeLiz and Ray Dillon, which is kind of the two detectives, the man and the woman, half and half.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't have that one.
And so that might have clued me in, but, you know, you don't really think about much. Yeah.
Mine, it's all three characters on there.
So I really like those when a character's in a situation and sort of the reality of it is in question and the rules of it, and yeah, you're sort of left to figure out. So it's very... I mean, I'm probably going to... There's a chance I might move it to trade just because I think it's going to work well in batches, but this issue, a lot happens. It was perfectly set up, had a good twist.
I'm kind of excited for the next one, so I think I'll be collecting an issue. I feel like I really got my money's worth, like a good, nice long story.
Oh, yeah, I gave it to my wife last night, and she loved it. She was like, this is great. We got to read more of it. So it was entertaining. And like I said, I know there's the JMS knock that he doesn't finish or whatever, but I'm in for it for the ride. It's a fun setup. And
yeah, even Steve, if I get one good storyline, I think for this type of story, that'll be nice.
And Steve, you were reading his sidekick book, right? And you were enjoying that one.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like he's one of those guys, like I said, that it seems maybe it's just all smoke and no mirrors, but I think he's a fun writer and this is a good property. And like I said, the artwork, I was unfamiliar with the artist, but it's, you know, suits the story. There isn't really a lot for me to say about it, I'd say.
No, but it does its job.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of shadows, as you might imagine, because it's evoking that sort of, like I said, Dragnet. I think in his liner notes he mentions the ones he watched was like Adam 12, but he also mentions Dragnet, Mannix, those kind of old-timey police shows, which mm-hmm. the art is very evocative of.
So is this like the Icon issue or continue after that? Because they had that one issue come out through Icon.
Years this is back. Image.
This is Joe's Comics imprint, which is his, I believe, specific. I don't know if Sidekick is that too, but most of the ones I've seen from him have that, like next to the Image circle is the little Joe's Comics.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if they reprinted like the first one that came out earlier and then continued onward or something.
Oh, he did this before?
Yeah, it was one shot, I believe. So I was just curious how that lines up with the new material and the old material.
Yeah, I didn't even know they had...
I had not read the old one. To me, this is all set, and according to JMS, it's the fifth new title from this imprint. So I'm not really... You know, these imprints... I'm trying to take Phil's attitude, which is just enjoy what comes out and try not to worry about, you know, is this going to last forever? What's going to go on? Just kind of ride it. But it seems like he's building a pretty good sized stable of, you know, his own top cow or however they're branding it now. But they make a point to have the Image logo on there too, equally prominent, if not more so. So
yeah, kind of, yeah. Stands out to you first.
Yeah, I think that would be probably more important. You remember that stack of mind management from the previous episode? Well, I also had a stack of the massive.
By the way, before you jump into that, I read the 21st pseudo-silent issue of Mind Management. And, hey, there was a lot to read in that silent issue. But man, the artwork is, that's actually the first issue of Mind Management that I've read, and it really is so, I mean, you can see the artist's work as he's slapping it on what you're looking at, basically original art pages, by seeing the original borders and stuff like that, so you really get a sense of what's being done there and what's being produced, and fantastic, really, really cool stuff.
So you're intrigued to read more.
Yep, but I also see what a cerebral commitment it's going to be to get into it. So although I want to, it's probably going to be a while before I jump into it.
Yeah. Well, it's cool that he's trying out some different things. Like, he's using comics.
He sure is. But now, the Massive.
Isn't it thematically required of you, Kevin, to wait till you have a massive stack before you read the Massive?
I would say no, because the story's like after like every disaster has happened on Earth. Like, the oceans have like been fished, the volcanoes have erupted, there's been earthquakes. Like, it's a basically a post-apocalyptic world type of thing, and people are trying to survive, but it's like a real world thing. Like, if you know, if something were to happen, if there were possibly some secret behind, it's kind of vague in the series, behind like why there was all these environmental disasters at the same time. So getting back to the whole stack idea, they're after this lost, like, Greenpeace type of ship that's supposed to be really big, like, so the Massive. But they're a small ship. So you could think of the small ship that you're following in the comic as a single issues, and you're after that elusive big stack. So you don't have to wait till you have a massive stack. Confused?
I'm right there with you, man.
But anyways, yes, I did have a stack of issues like that, just like Mind Management, also from Dark Horse and from Brian Wood. And now I'm trying to remember who the artist was, because they've had a few different artists, but it might have been Gary Brown, I'm not sure. Because it was, I was sort of like in between arcs, and then I went into a new arc. So it's usually dealing with the crew members on the ship. And while I enjoy the series, it's pretty much as different as you can get from Mind Management. Like, this is a very real world, and I wouldn't say it's as meaty. Like, there's some, it's more like you'll be introduced to an idea, and then you'll think about it afterwards, going, oh yeah, I wonder how that's happening in the real world. Because they'll bring up something, and then you'll be like, oh yeah. Like, they'll say something about overfishing, or just some kind of neat fact about the world, and then that'll spin off in their story. So while I still think it's cool, I think it's started to head in a different direction, and I'm kind of waiting to see how that plays out. And it also seems like they're headed towards like an end point sometime soon, but I could see like some of the main characters sort of going away and them heading off on a mission, because I used to do like, I guess, like sort of environmental stuff before. But then the world sort of, like, ended in a way. So they're like, well, what's an environmentalist to do when the whole world is screwed up and they can't put the world back together again? So it seems like they're finally getting to a point where they're going to have a new mission statement and what they should do, where they should go, who they should arrest, or whatever. So I'm kind of thinking if that's going to, like, wrap up the series, or if it's going to head off in some crazy new direction. But on this one, they go into Europe in the arc I just read, because they have a new arc starting, but it focuses on a different character. Because one of the characters basically has some illness, and like he's been keeping it from the crew, and things haven't been going so well for him. And some stuff goes down, and then the new arc happens, and then you're in Africa, and you're getting some background on one of the other characters. It seems like it's been pretty realistic, but it seems like it might be going into some crazy pseudoscience territory. I don't know. It's kind of hard to describe. I'm definitely intrigued still in the series, but I'm definitely more invested in Mind Management than I was in the Massive. They've had some other things like sharks and or like fish where there's no overfishing anymore. So in one area, they're like, destroying the environment because their predators or something's changed in the balance of the seas. And some of the stuff is starting to, like, come back where there was this interesting arc early on where all these oil rigs were starting to be, like, brought together, so they are sort of, like, building a civilization on the ocean. And one of the guys from that arc comes back and some mean stuff goes down. But they've had some really cool places to go to where they went to, I'm going to say it was Hong Kong, where, like, the water levels had risen, so you only had, like, the skyscrapers sticking out of the water. So you took all these, like, shipping containers, and you basically filled all the water streets in between and attached it to the skyscrapers. So now it's like that was your land. Like, all the metal was, like, the streets and everything on top of the water, and you could still live, like, in the building, sort of. Like, really creative stuff, but pretty realistic most of the time.
It would be tough to know exactly what a post-apocalyptic scenario would be, though.
Yeah, I don't know if that's very realistic.
It's not just, like, one disaster. It's, like, every disaster at once. So even if you were going to, like, do something, it's like I can see why he didn't want to go to the U.S. right at the beginning of the series, but once you get there, it's like the whole eastern seaboard is, like, flooded. Wherever, like, the mountains start to form or whatever, it's like, that's where the U.S. starts now. So it's sort of like, yeah, it's like, what can you do? How can you recover that land? It's like the U.S. is, like, half the size or something.
And then Andrew's like really laughing because up. It's the West Coast that's supposed to slide into the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. So that Colorado can become oceanfront property.
Yeah.
Isn't that what we were all, like, promised?
But then you also have, like, all the nuclear stuff and, like, the submarines, and it's just, like, that is just royally screwed.
Welcome to the future.
Exactly.
I thought it was going to be, like, a Magnus robot humper that we saw. That's the future I'm holding out for.
Or are you holding out for a giant floating Japanese city in the sky, like in Rai?
That would work, although, you know, I don't know if I buy the there's been no murder committed for 1,000 years. They always love that in them futuristic ones.
I assume there's still been crimes committed, though, right? It's just no one's been, like, really murderous?
Well, they have the police force, so you would think
so. Like, it's like there's been, well, they say there's been protests, but the protesters haven't gone hostile, so no one's been murdered. But yeah, it seems like there's a group of people that are trying to free people from technology or something, kind of like Magnus in a way.
And what we're referring to obliquely is one of Valiant's new offerings,
Old Bloodshot.
Rye, number one, but don't be fooled, fair listeners. It's R-A-I is the title. And it's Matt Kent, who is the genius behind the aforementioned mind management, and Clayton Crane doing the art duties. And it's, like I said, Valiant's new book, and it's set in the future. And it's its own thing. It's pretty, well, it's Matt Kent, so you're not going to have something that's plain and ordinary.
So is he a future Bloodshot program person, I guess? Like someone, like a Weapon X type person?
I thought he might be the same one, to be honest with you.
Okay, I've never been clear on that.
Yeah, like there was a connection in the old Valiant universe, but in this one, I'm not sure if they will have something like that.
Because he has the symbol, though, so he has to be connected in some way.
Well, he has a Japanese flag, though. It's not as...
Oh, that's true, yeah, they changed
it. It's not as obvious as the old one.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd think that he is certainly a character that could live under the premise of the Valiant universe. Bloodshot's a character that's been injected with these super powerful nanites. So it's presumable that the nanites could keep him alive for to live in the future, and he would probably be somewhat changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I took it to be the same character, but I don't think you need to. It very well could be somebody different, because clearly he's his own man. And the whole setup is, you know, what's coming on in this strange world. Can he's an enforcer of the law. but can he trust the system? Because he takes his orders from something called Father, which is presumably a computer program or something equally futuristic. It gave me kind of a Blade Runner feel. Would that be fair, boys?
Yeah, I think that would be pretty accurate.
Not to push anybody into anything, but that's where I got. And so I enjoyed the fact that, like, nothing is easily left for you. You really are just dumped into this world and kind of have to figure it out. And they're like, at certain times they use a little bit of slang as well. And again, that's not broken down for you. You just got to kind of power through it. And Clayton Crane is obviously a well-known artistic talent, and you're going to get art that looks like Clayton Crane. And if you like that, you're going to like this issue, I would say. And I like it. I mean, I like different styles, but his style as well. Kind of reminds me of, I'm going to say those guys that work in video games, that kind of hard detailed art. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know if you would call it, like, it's almost in between, like, computer generated or painted, because it almost has that, like, weird realism. I don't know how to really describe it, but it looks...
Yeah, I would imagine
it does look like video games, though. Yeah,
yeah.
It looks like rendered.
I would imagine some of this is done on a computer.
Oh, I think I haven't seen the work for there, but you know his previous work for Marvel is computer generated. But I had the pleasure of watching him paint on a sketch cover at Boston Comic Con last year or the year before, I forget which. But it was really entertaining watching him paint because he was getting close to the same effect, without adding all the blacks, because he was starting on the figure first, and he wasn't going to do a big black background. But the way he was laying down the color on top of each other and the highlights, especially on top of the darks, I was like, "Holy cow! This guy knows how to paint, and he's really painting with light when he's doing the he's not a computer guy; he's a painter guy." He's really using that as a tool in the best sense of the word.
Yeah, I think that for that type of art, he's at the top of the game. Like, if that's what you like, you're going to be very satisfied. I ended up picking up, for a friend of mine, I picked up one of the variant covers they had at C2E2, so as a special. Because I don't mind Mulan comics for people.
Cool, I'll keep checking my mailbox, Andrew.
I wasn't the biggest
All of you except Kevin fans. Have received various...
Oh, I'm not complaining, Andrew. I've made up excellently in this friendship.
Although, we never did get Phil's review of any of the comics I sent him.
Hmm. Let's just keep on talking about Ryan. I wasn't biggest Crane fan before this, but looking at this, I think I'm being swayed, because this is clear. It's not hard to figure out what's going on, even though the style of art is what it is. Like, I would be scared it would get lost somewhere, but it's not really a problem.
No, the storytelling is very. I mean, what's happening is clear. It's a little bit, because it's a futuristic world, and you're dropped in. You got to work for it, but yeah, there's no ambiguity in the action sequences.
And I like how Kint is really doing some world building here, because he introduces you to all these different sectors, and it looks like you can go to like all these different worlds, almost like neighborhoods, and like there's a lot of he can go to, and a lot of places like they can have more murders or whatever.
Yes, well, it just feels like a good science fiction.
Yeah.
Like a hard science fiction comic, although I'm no science fiction expert, and we don't have a ton of that that's done with this kind of, comprehensive world building, where they're just not gonna give you anything. And too many books, they'd spend a lot of time describing, you know, what this is and what the slang is and everything. And I like that Kint just is like, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, I'm probably.
I bet some cool future versions of the other characters will show up eventually.
I would say that's less likely a case. Either the Eternal Warrior or someone like that.
Mm-hmm.
Armstrong?
I guess so. Depending upon how that situation works with Armstrong. But yeah, I could see him showing up or some other...
Well, one of those organizations, like Harbingers or whatever, wouldn't they be able to... There'd be like future versions of a new batch or whatever?
Possibly. But it doesn't look like there's anyone really with... Like beyond Rai himself, it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of superhero
connections or
stuff going on. Like there could be on the Earth itself, but I'm thinking if there was some kind of Harbinger characters, like they would have.
Did they have similar companies and stuff that are in the older ones? Like not the older ones, but like the present time Valiant comics. Like they didn't have any crossover with that even.
Well, you know, I can speak. I actually went to the WonderCon panel and sort of live tweeted it because they are moving their way to, they're kind of canceling a lot of their books at 25 and then relaunching them in new series, which I think sort of the Hellboy style, which I think is a pretty smart move. So a lot of them like Harbinger 25 is the last one. And I wouldn't be surprised to see more of them moving in interesting directions like that. But yeah, I ended up sitting through that, and that's how I found out.
What will take its place, though?
They'll just do a new. You know, they have new. A lot of them are going to be intentionally limited series, like Harbinger Omegas.
Yeah,
three issue. So they're gonna. It's not like they're going away, but they're moving to a model where they're not going to be contingent on all the issues having big numbers. Which I think will help drive people in. And because if you go to the panels, they give you a secret password. And it was Rye, and then they give you a comic if you come by their booth and give them the password. And the only reason I also mentioned it was, for once, normally I don't really bother live tweeting that much because of my limited reach, but Bleeding Cool ended up stealing one of my photos and posting it. And they credited me, though.
That was awesome.
So... Bleeding Cool and Independent Comic Book Noise meeting together.
Yeah, it looks like Exo Manowar is the only one that's going to continue its numbering.
So I think that it'll be... I think it's smart. People like number ones and different things, and it allows them maybe some flexibility. I think they have a solid... we've talked about this before. It's a solid product. I just don't know... I don't know where they're... if they've hit like kind of a cap, and I don't know how they're going to reach, because it's just, we get kind of that cohesive universe from Marvel and DC and a lot of other places, so it's tough to be like, hey, we're offering you that, but it's our version, where a lot of us go for the indies to give us something slightly different.
Yeah, because if you were just going to say, oh, we'll just make good stories, and then you're like, well, that doesn't always sell the best if you just create good stories, but hopefully it works out.
Well, it has to be, you have to have a type of thing you're offering. I mean, good stories is too generic. Like, what do you make? Like, are you doing, so like I said, they do a shared universe, cohesive, kind of in the Marvel and DC mold with a little less fantastical elements. And that's a tough sell, I think. I mean, Steve's talked about, to some degree, to throw him under the bus because he stopped.
Oh, totally throw him under the bus. When he says something, I totally throw him under the bus.
Valiant is the hugest of blind spots in my comic world. So,
well, I just think that part of it is they have this, you know, comprehensive universe, and it's a tough sell to get you to buy like a couple of new books.
Too many comics out there.
You get that itch scratched from Marvel and DC.
Right.
I don't get it from DC. They basically replaced DC on my poll list because I'm like, what's DC doing for me? Nothing.
Oh, because you're an internet troll.
No.
Phil will always stick up for the distinguished.
I know.
I'll stick up for any company.
he's going to stick up for Blue Water.
Except for Blue Water. But I didn't know, okay? I
didn't know. We tried to read the Monty Python book, but
it ended up not
being
a
sequential comic and ended up just being pictures with captions giving us the most barest bone history of the Monty Python brand.
Yeah.
So be it.
Yeah. So, yeah, once again, Matt Pitt impresses me. Like, when doesn't he use the impress? It's like he has a certain sci-fi thing locked down, and I'm like, yeah, that's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I've been pretty happy with everything I've read of his so far.
Doesn't he write a lot of DC that Kevin doesn't read?
Yes, yeah. He did. God, what is it?
He did, but doesn't now.
He did a few issues of Suicide Squad, a few issues of Frankenstein.
Okay, I guess he was more of a filler then, like he filled in arcs maybe here and
there. Yeah, and then when
they
needed, when they were doing, what was that, hologram month? You know, they needed all those extra issues. He was writing like 8 or 10 of those.
That's right.
So, he's been doing a lot of stopgap stuff, it seems like.
Well, we should wrap this up, guys, before we step on the DC Noise folks' toes.
Oh, that would never happen.
But thanks for joining us again for another episode of Indie Comic Book Noise. You can find us on our Facebook page and get our Twitter handles from there and bug us on Twitter. And we have a forum that's part of the Comic Book Noise forums that's part of the 11 O'Clock Comics forums. We're like the little armpit of the 11 O'Clock Comics forums.
Or arsehole.
I was thinking we were the cherry on top of the sundae, but...
Oh!
Step outside the box, read some indie comics, and let us know what you think.
See you in the future.
Later. Woo!
There was a little old man who lived in Montreal, with a wife and a kid and a car and a house and a teenage daughter with a see-through blouse who loved to grunt and bawl. And her name was Magdalena. In Montreal, he caught his daughter in the blouse by the light, and he said to himself, she looks all right. He reached for a tin and grabbed it tight and threw her up against the wall. Blue Cross Magdalena, my daughter's here, do not be concerned when your Canadian daddy comes here. My daughter dear, do not be concerned when your Canadian daddy comes here. I work so hard, don't you understand, making maple syrup for the pancakes of our land. Do you have any idea what that can do to a man? What that can do to a man? Do you have any idea? Was drooling a bit as he reached for a tin, and he said to himself, this is gonna be it. But the girl turned around and said, go eat shit, and ran on down the hall. Right on Magdalena. My daughter dear, do not be concerned when your Canadian daddy comes here. My daughter dear, do not be concerned when your Canadian daddy comes here. I work so hard, don't you understand, making maple syrup for the pancakes of our land. Do you have any idea what that can do to a man? What that can do to a man? Do you have any idea? Don't you treat me like this? Why in the hallway?
daughter of the smogville winds of Los Angeles. I'd like to take you in the closet and take off your little clothes until you are virtually stark raving nude. Spread mayonnaise and kale pectin all over your body and take you down to Hollywood Boulevard, and we can walk down the street by the stars that say John Provost and Leo G. Carroll together, baby. We can go dancing up at the Cinegrill. Can't you see it? Frank Cornell and us until dawn. Don't you understand, my baby? I mean, it was so hard for me. I saw you standing under the Shell Pest Strip late last night in the light with your little nipples protruding through your little see-through thingy, and I just said, my God, I gave my sperm to this thing, and now I just... Oh, you had me so hard, I didn't know what to do, Magdalena, don't you understand? So I grabbed you, but don't hold it against me. I mean, your mama never knows, baby, and I want you to come back to me. I mean, do you understand me? I want you to... I'm down on my knees to your Magdalena, I want you to walk back to me, baby. I want you to turn around by the Sparklets machine. That's it, in the little chartreuse hallway with the little neon Jesus picture on the wall. And I want you to step, baby. I want you to walk back in your 5-inch spike heels that you got at Frederick's. Same time you and your mommy got that crotchless underwear last year for Christmas. And I want you to stroll back to me, baby. Walk back, baby. I want you to stand me, baby. I want you to walk back. I'm down on my bended knees, baby. I'm gonna take off your little training bra. Don't you understand me? I'm gonna take off your little maroon hot pants. I'm gonna get down on my knees, baby. Don't you understand what I'm saying to you? Your mama never knows. She's playing bridge with the girls. And you and I know the sun comes up, baby. It's just you and I. Don't understand. We can make love all night long. Why don't you let me know? Come on, Magdalena. Please, little girl. Walk back to your daddy. What did I do that was so wrong? My God, it was all in following the sexual impulse I heard on the Johnny Carson show from a book that some guy wrote.